Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Recorded live in California, USA. It's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. The show that loves big, likes pop, and has fun. Now from the Wilson World Studios, here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, a podcast. I'm Tom Wilson. I am your host. I hope you're ready for a magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder as we crack that whip, give the past the slip, step on a crack, break our mama's back, and whip it good. And... I don't know. Yeah, as with all the magical sleigh rides, I don't know where they come from. But we are delving into the heart of the human experience. And isn't that good? Isn't that good? I don't – look, believe me, I'm not one of those guys saying, well, these people today with the screens on the computers, nobody talks to each other anymore. But I am sort of curious as to when Twitter will change or some new iteration of social media will begin and they'll say it's 60 characters and you only get 25% of a photo and you have to put in sort of, you know, half of your aunt's head and just say splashy. And that will begin an entire new way of communicating with each other that will probably – like everything else, devolve into a bunch of incredibly disrespectful hand gestures that we'll just make to each other. I have no idea. But my point being, I'm enjoying talking with people. I'm enjoying taking this time. And I'm glad that a lot of people are too, that a lot of you guys are writing me, emailing me, and have an interest in just talking to people, most of whom, of course, are involved in the entertainment industry. But how does that happen? What kind of kid actually makes these decisions? What's your family like? Where are you from? How do you get here? What do you do now? At the start of my comedy career in LA, as I've said here ad nauseum before, I walked into the Comedy Store on July 20th, 1981. Yes. I remember noting because it was that was the... What was it, 12th anniversary of men, the first man who walked on the moon, Neil Armstrong. And like that experience with the Apollo 11, my walking into the Comedy Store was one small step for man and one – it wasn't a particularly giant leap anywhere. It was actually one small step for man and then another small step for man and then another and another, and then I was on stage. And as I've said here before, it was an unusual time. The comedy boom hadn't started yet. And many, many unusual and just odd things were happening on stage. It was fun. It was amazing. And my guest today, Ned Gill, was a part of that. Ned actually was accepted at the Comedy Store the same night I was. Ned had come. We talk about it in the conversation. Ned had come from a completely improvisational environment, the beginnings of theatrical improvisation with Games for the Theater and Viola Spolin and Avery Schreiber's workshop, Story Theater and Paul Sills, many, many, now historic movements in American theater history that Ned was actually part of. So at that time, a lot of people were coming onto the stage because at the comedy clubs, that was where you could actually find a crowd. That's where people were coming because the club could sell drinks and sell bad chicken fingers and actually make money. And instead of the mime who would be a street performer, the mime was in – well, Robert Shields was one of the mimes. I mean, Robert Shields and Lorraine Yarnell were two mimes of just – again, historic importance. Robert Shields basically invented the robot. You know that dance with the jerky moves where at the end you have actually become a mechanical man or woman and you're kind of sliding across the stage? It became a dance because of Michael Jackson. Boy, it's teaching time with Tom for this introduction. But Robert Shields was a historic mime from San Francisco, and Lorraine Yarnell, and they were on – they were trying to commercialize this very entertaining but odd, let's face it, way of entertaining people. So Robert Shields was literally around the Comedy Store trying to commercialize an act, trying to put together what would it be like if I did 20 minutes alone just myself – of trying to make it funny, not only the mime being trapped in the glass box and having the tug of war with a rope and climbing a ladder and being a robot, but how could I maybe put that together for it to be considered stand-up comedy where I could make some money. Anyway, myriad people were doing it. Literally, Debbie Reynolds, okay, came to the stage of the comedy. Yes, the old movie star Debbie Reynolds put together an act with a puppet and everything and was trying to put it together at the Comedy Store. It's Bette Midler was there. Bud Cort was an actor. I'm talking too long. Bud Cort was an actor from Harold and Maude. Very, you know, unusual guy. Very, very thin and in a sense, a Crispin Glover of his time. A proto Crispin. Bud Cort. If you haven't seen Harold and Maude, please go put it in your Netflix queue. It's a very interesting movie. But Bud Cort was there doing odd prose readings and singing songs and things. Anyway, that's the time of the Comedy Store. And that's when I met my guest, Ned Gill, who had come out out of all this improvisation and freeform theater and a lot of places where, as we know, you will have four people, two of whom work at the theater in folding chairs, and you'll be performing your odd pieces to them. So Ned came to the Comedy Store to try to put an act together. Anyway, he's an interesting guy with an interesting perspective on the stage, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Ned Gill.
It's Big Pop Fun.
I don't have my headset on.
Have you? You don't? We're not wearing headsets. We're not taking any callers.
Oh, okay.
We're not giving away fog hat tickets. We're not doing anything like that.
I was ready for callers.
You wanted callers?
Yeah, I did.
All right. We're going to have to fake some callers. I've always been fascinated by your life, Ned, as you know, because you're like a total California kid.
Yeah, I grew up.
You were born and raised here, and it's always seemed like there are seven people like you. Of course, there are many more than that. There have to be 12 to 15, but you grew up at a really golden age of California.
Yeah, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and it truly was Mayberry. I mean, but it was a Hollywood Mayberry, so it was different, you know.
Yeah, what was Hollywood Mayberry like? In the middle of the valley.
We were a middle class neighborhood, so a lot of middle class Hollywood lived all around us.
And who was middle class Hollywood at that time?
Bobby Diamond, who was the star of Fury. I don't know if that dates me too much.
Wow, that did. Yeah.
Oh, okay, but
Fury. What was that? Was that
Fury
a horse
was
thing?
A Saturday morning horse show. Yeah,
a horse show.
Horse. Yeah.
A boy and his horse.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we the house that we lived on was Tex Ritter's ex ranch that they developed the property.
Uh huh.
So and then all sorts of character actors lived in our neighborhood, and I was friends with their kids. Like, I don't know if Billy Sands rings a bell, but he was on McHale's Navy. I grew up with his kids. Skip Holmeyer, who was a character actor.
So you grew up in a neighborhood where it was just normal that people just were actors for a living.
Yeah. One of my best friends' dads directed Gilligan's Island. But it wasn't it was funny because it wasn't a part. It wasn't different or weird or
right. It just wasn't. Yeah. It was show business, but that's just what people's dads and moms did, or something.
They worked at Lockheed or Warner Brothers. The man who lived next door to me was one of Walt Disney's I didn't know this until last year. He was one of Walt Disney's closest men, and when Walt Disney did that trip to South America during the war, he was one of the guys that was there with him. His job. This is my next door neighbor. His job was to do all the foreign dubbing for all Disney movies, and he just was.
How did you learn that last year?
They made a documentary about that trip,
and you just looked at it and said, "That's our neighbor."
No, I knew my neighbor worked for Walt Disney, and I knew he was pretty high up, but you have never known it. And I found all this.
So Walt didn't pay that much because he was just in a. He was a Walt. Disney's high up, his right hand man.
Just lived in Van Nuys.
Did all of Walt's work, and he lived in a 2-bedroom house in Van Nuys.
And I went to school with some kids. One of the kids in my class, Rory Shevin, was in the Birds. He got his eyes picked out.
Really?
Yes.
Was that really cool to kids at school?
Oh, so cool.
How could you not love that?
I know. So when
the kid who has his eyes picked out by birds in an Alfred Hitchcock movie goes to your school?
Yes, see. So
man.
It was kind of, a friend of my parents was a very famous character actor. Gosh, I can't remember his name. I just watched him in Key Largo.
But he was very famous.
Yeah, he was.
You can't remember his name.
How famous
was he as a character actor?
Well,
you better come up with a new character.
Dan
for
Seymour,
your
that's it. That's
oh,
it.
Dan
now,
Seymour.
Now, why he was cool to me, not because he worked with Bogart, but he was in Superman. He was a villain.
Oh, he was a villain in Superman, the TV show.
Yes, and to me
Strange
that was...
visitor from another planet.
Yeah, that was the coolest thing to me ever. And like I say, on weekends, we would go down to Corganville. I don't know if you know what that is.
Man, this is like way in prehistoric LA time, so I'm like, I'm a newcomer here.
Corganville was a movie ranch, and they used to film The Lone Ranger there. And on weekends, you could go down and they'd charge a small admission, and you could watch stunt shows and a hanging, and sometimes Clayton Moore
would be
there.
And that was just here in LA?
Just outside.
Yeah.
The ranch is called the Spawn Ranch later, and you might know it for other reasons, but it kind of put a taint on it. So
I don't know.
Charles Manson kind of.
Oh, so, wow. That's kind of a taint.
Yes.
That's a pretty severe taint when you go from watching some stunt shows and cowboys to the Manson
family. No, we didn't
family.
Go watch them.
You didn't watch the Manson family.
Right.
That's good to know.
Yes, just like
good to know. You just were at the parties with Dennis Wilson and Charlie when they were but not you didn't know what was going to happen eventually.
No.
So you went to Corriganville with your friends and you would watch stunt shows and everything.
Yeah.
And did you from the very beginning did you think, "Boy, I just want to be around this stuff?" Or was it
I can point to actually where the decision came into my head. And if you grew up in Los Angeles on local television at 5 a.m. in the morning, every morning was Laurel and Hardy and Buster Keaton.
At 5 a.m.?
Yeah, 5 a.m. Because they didn't have anything to show, you know? So it was...
So did you ever sleep? You were up?
I'd get up, turn on the TV, and just watch all these wonderful... Our gang, all that stuff. And I remember there's a scene in Fra Diablo, if you know... the movie at all.
I don't know anything you're talking about so far. I've missed you've done 18 references of which have all gone over my head.
It's a Laurel and Hardy film, and in the film, Ollie has to be hung, and Stan has to hang him.
Uh-huh.
And they're in tears, and they're saying goodbye to each other. And the joke is he hangs him, and the rope breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as a kid, had never been in tears and then laughing the moment later. And I said, wow, I want to do that.
Really?
Yeah, and... Actually, it was that point that I actually knew that.
And so you're living in L.A. and you're going to all those whatever they had. I mean, it seems like everyone I know from Los Angeles has all those POP Park or something. Or
Pacific Ocean Park, yeah.
Pacific Ocean Park and all of the – I mean, you had Disneyland.
Yeah, it was only like $3 too.
It was $3 to get into Disneyland?
I know. People are shocked when they
Did you go
that.
That there a lot?
Yeah, yeah.
So you went to Disneyland a lot. I mean, they had submarines there.
Yes, I know.
You know,
POP was 99 cents.
House, they just played these things on TV, Saturday morning TV, where they go, "This is Disneyland. Other children who are way luckier than you live near there. It's only $3 to go in."
I know.
They go on real submarines. Yes. Sure, there are fake fish, but they're real submarines. Kids from Philadelphia, you can't go there.
Well, you could go to Freedom Land. Did you ever go to Freedom Land?
Freedom Land?
Yeah. That was New York.
That was in New York?
It lasted like 6 months.
Well, yeah. What's Freedom Land? I've never even heard of Freedom Land.
It's a big amusement park.
Where was that? I mean,
somewhere in New York.
What was
this,
in the 60s or something?
I never got to go. Yeah, yeah.
Freedom Land.
Yeah,
no, we never went to.
If you have Google and you're listening to this, look up Freedom Land. So.
We never went to Freedom Land.
Okay.
So what did you do?
Did you go to that amusement park where Superman always sat on the back of the comics? Palisades Park? Did you ever go there?
Never went there.
I wanted to go there just because Superman did the ads.
Well, you lived near a villain from Superman.
That's
you
true.
Knew the guy.
Well, yeah.
So did he try to stab Superman or shoot him?
Oh, he had a gun.
So he shoots him, all the bullets bounce off,
and then
he throws the gun at Superman.
Yes, how'd you know?
But as every comic who did this bit knows, then at the end, when they throw the gun at Superman, Superman ducks.
Yeah.
From the gun being thrown at him, Superman is afraid.
Yes.
The bullets possibly ripping into his flesh, he has no fear.
No.
He stands there.
Yes.
Throw a gun at him, and he goes, oh, and he ducks.
It's a big thing.
It's bigger. It's going way, way slower than a bullet,
yes,
but it is significantly larger.
That's true.
So he ducks when the gun.
Well, it's a scary thing.
It is not to Superman.
No.
He just stared down bullets.
Okay. He's still Superman.
He is Superman. So they shot him. They didn't have this the rubber knife that bent. Yes.
I have the episode, I'm sure, somewhere I could dig it out.
I'm sure you do. Okay. You have an entire subterranean village here full of videos.
The first time I went to a movie set was there was a local department store called May Company, and they had a contest. And you could win a trip to the Great Race set. And,
are you kidding me?
No. I have pictures of me in Professor Fate's car here.
Are you kidding
me? No. So that was like the coolest thing. But the even cooler thing that day was they were shooting F Troop around the corner.
Ah, and Larry Storch.
Yes, Larry Storch.
And Larry Storch beats Jack Lemmon and Tody Curtis? Natalie Wood?
They weren't there. We were just on the sets.
That Professor Fate's car is cooler than Larry Storch.
In person?
And I met Larry Storch. And I'm not saying that he's not charming. He's
right.
Charming he's man and a very nice man,
yes, very nice
and
man.
Very funny. I saw him in a play in New York, of all things, a play called Breaking Legs on the Upper West Side in New York. He's very, very gracious afterwards. But had he been blocking me from seeing Professor Fate's car, I would have shoved him aside.
No, it wasn't. He wasn't blocking me.
I know, no. But you were going around the corner to meet Larry Storch.
Right, and watch F Troop being made.
Did you end up meeting Larry Storch? You really did?
Yes. And it was one of those just those moments where your kind of mouth drops and go, wow, this is F Troop. And as a kid, I always liked the weirder things. And for a sitcom in those days, F Troop was a pretty weird show.
F Troop was pretty outside.
Yeah.
Pretty outside the box.
Yeah. I mean, you look at it now, it's, you know, you like that. You know,
And
it was kind of cool. So.
So you didn't, but The Great Race was just a movie and you didn't know what it would be about.
No. So,
right. So you just saw this car.
Yes.
The number 8.
I'll show you pictures.
I trust you.
All right. Okay.
I believe you. The Great Race is one of the real gems of Hollywood filmmaking.
My family
loves that movie.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Boy.
Yeah. Jack Lemmon was a very, very nice
Jack
man.
Jack Lemmon was a very, very nice man. In fact, I got to meet him and he was terrific.
Yeah. I'll tell you a really cool story is,
Does it involve Jack Lemmon and Larry Storch?
No.
I hope we move to Larry Storch.
No, Larry Storch.
Okay.
But I was at the Ginger Man with Harvey Limbeck, who was my improv teacher.
We're going to get there.
Oh, okay. But we were just having lunch, and Jack Lemmon comes by and says hello, and Harvey asks him to sit down. So, you know, how could you not say no to have Jack Lemmon sit down? So Jack Lemmon's sitting down, saying hi, and Harvey looks at his watch and says, you know what, I've got to go. Excuse me, guys. Nice, you know. And he leaves. And
so Harvey, your teacher, who you were having lunch with,
leaves.
At the Ginger Man, which if people don't know, it's no longer
here. It was Carol O'Connor's
bar and restaurant, a very, very fashionable thing to be in.
And so Harvey leaves, and Jack Lemmon's sitting there and goes, mind if I stay? 4 hours, he sat and told us stories.
With you
and a friend.
A couple of young actors.
Yeah, just.
And he just told you stories.
All afternoon we just spent with Jack Lemmon, just him telling stories about shopping on Beverly Drive, and he was going to buy some shoes, and he found out that they were $1,200, and he said, I don't want to buy them, but I'm Jack Lemmon. How can I not buy these shoes? They'll think I'm cheap. So he bought shoes he didn't want for $1,200.
Wow.
So
I'd never do that.
No.
Unless, Larry Storch was with me, and then I'm trying to impress Larry Storch. But so you lived this not a Hollywood dream, not being around the movies, but where it was all normal to you.
Yeah.
It was all normal to you. And you went off to school. You went to Long Beach State, which is right here.
Right.
Because
they had a good theater department, so.
Were you doing plays in school instead of high school?
Well, yeah.
High school plays, college plays.
Yeah.
So,
in fact, the funny story is at our college, we got a call from a studio saying they were making a film and they wanted to see if any actors wanted to come down. And the film was Star Wars. And no one wanted to go. No one in the whole, you know, who wants to go down to Hollywood and read for that? And I said, are you kidding me?
Are you serious?
So I went down with another friend and we were sitting in Francis Ford Coppola's office. And he had all the little models for... they were sharing an office at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And all the little models for Apocalypse Now. All the little helicopters and everything. And so I'm sitting, it was like a moment my mouth was dropping. And They had me read for Han Solo. Don't ask me why.
Read for Han Solo? Yeah, Ned Gill, ladies and gentlemen, auditioned for the role of Han Solo.
They said it was a Richard Dreyfuss type. That's what they had said.
Yeah. So, and that's, you know, that's not you, but that's within your wheelhouse.
Yeah, it wasn't something that it was a little stretch. But yeah,
not outside the realm of possibility. Right, so you are in George Lucas's office and you audition for Han Solo. Yeah. Like what kind of, was it a scene that ended up in the movie?
Yeah, it was one of those scenes. I don't really remember that well. It's just that that was my brush with greatness.
Yeah, so, audition almost.
Yes, this interview probably would go very differently had I got that role.
Well, I'll bet. Yeah. I'll bet it wouldn't even be happening.
Okay, but you never
bet
know.
It
you
wouldn't
never,
be happening.
You never know. So,
far, Harrison Ford, not a guest on the Big Pop Fun podcast.
All right, you should.
Larry Storch, very possible.
Is Larry Storch alive? Sorry.
I'm just pausing because... I'll cut in.
All right.
I'll cut in to my interview with you, and it'll seem like I already knew.
Okay, that's good.
So I'm going to cut in now and just go.
Somebody say, let's hire Larry Storch for this, and I hear this.
You know what? I'm going to go for he's alive.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to bet that he's alive.
All right.
Because he's a nice guy,
yeah.
A funny man.
Thank you.
And I saw him in a play some 25 years ago or something, 20 years ago. So you, what I wanted to get to is that Harvey Lembeck class, because you get out of college.
But there was a few classes before that. I was with Avery Shriver, and I don't know if you know.
Well, I did know that, in fact, and thank you for reminding me, because that you came out of college and everything, like everyone does, and you did plays and everything, but you began studying with what was the very core of kind of the beginnings of the improv scene nationally.
Yeah, it truly was.
Avery Schreiber was Betty Thomas. Betty Thomas.
Right.
Seminal figures in the very beginning of what has now become an industry. It's now, of course, nation and worldwide improv and improv Olympics and improv sports and all that.
I actually wanted to move to Chicago and join Second City, and I actually wrote a letter to Del Close, and Del Close wrote me back. And the letter went something like, "Dear Ned, our casting is erratic. You don't want to come here to Chicago. It's cold in the winter. Go to the Comedy Store." And I still have that letter.
Really?
Yeah.
So Del Close, for those who don't know, he ran Second City when it was just in one city.
Right.
It was just in Chicago, and that was the famous improv and sketch place to go or try to get in sketches to train and everything. But what was it? So how did you hook up with Avery Schreiber? If people don't know, he was in a comedy team.
Burns
with
and Schreiber.
Jack Burns.
Yeah, very
Burns
famous.
And Schreiber. Very famous comedy team that did a lot of talk shows and everything. But Avery Schreiber was
also the Frito Bandito.
He was the Frito Bandito.
He was on the Muppet Show too as a host.
Yeah.
That was one of the neatest things to him, that he got asked to do the Muppet Show. And I think for me that would be kind of the same honor.
Yeah,
do you know
yeah.
what I mean? Because at that time, that was like the number one show in the world.
Right, right. So what did you do? He was just training?
No,
he had a class?
There was a thing called Sherwood Oaks College. I don't know if that rings any bell. It was kind of like an early precursor of UCLA Extension.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew Avery's work very well. And here it was, improv class taught by Avery Shriver, who basically... Avery was one of those people that was there at the beginning of improv,
right?
With Viola Spolin,
That's what I'm talking about. Viola Spolin theater games
Paul
stuff.
Paul Sills. This is
Paul Sills story theater.
Right.
The very beginning.
This is, I guess, my brush with another brush with greatness was I just loved Avery's work and I thought he was so funny, and I took the class and there was probably 20 of us. And including Chris Knight, so the Brady Bunch is a reoccurring theme.
Christopher Knight
was in my
studying
class.
With Avery, yes. Studying improv in Avery Schreiber's class with
yes.
you.
Right, so this must have been about, in the early 70s. So, and we used to do the thing they called the Herald. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Sure, long form.
Yeah, and we used to do these 2.5-hour improvs. And it was, I think what Avery taught me, because college didn't teach me this, it just kind of, You just kind of become completely free.
Yeah.
You're just kind of...
Did college train... Let's go back just for a sec. But did college acting teach you anything?
No. And here's what college acting... And when I went... I don't know if it's different now, but when I went to school, college theater was training you for a job in the theater. They couldn't relate to film. They couldn't relate to improv.
Mm-hmm.
They did have a children's theater department, there that for me was wonderful because it was the closest thing to improv,
right,
where you could do all these wonderful, bizarre, crazy things and just call it children's theater.
Yeah, you could exactly. So. Because the weird stuff, anyone doing anything outside the box was like, well, that must be for kids because we don't understand it.
And surprisingly for a school that was right here in town, they lived in a funny kind of bubble because one day John Voight called the school and said he'd like to do a production of Macbeth. And he would star, and he wanted student cast, and he'd direct. And the school said no. And I went, what? Why?
This is after, I guess, after winning the Oscar,
Home. Yes. So he took it down to Cal State Northridge and did it. And I kind of questioned everything, the school mentality of they did good shows, but they weren't preparing you for a professional job in Hollywood at all. And I wanted to go to the SC Film School. I did, but it was so, even then, for me to go to a summer, it was $5,000. And in 1971,
wow,
that's
a lot of money.
Yeah, and I just couldn't do it.
So you got out, as so many actors do. You got out of college as a college actor, realizing you didn't know what you were doing.
Right.
So you started going around improv. As we said, it was just the absolute beginnings of thinking about being free on stage and just saying what you want.
We didn't do these for audiences. This wasn't workshops or casting directors.
It wasn't a blackout scene as we know of now. Improv is where we're all kind of working on a joke. Everyone is looking at each other trying to form the joke.
That's not what this was.
And then when one person gets the punchline, there's a pianist who goes blah, 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 and then the lights go out, and that's a signal for the audience to clap, and then we go to the next thing. This was a very long form. You're just coming up with a character or some kind of premise, and no one, as you say, there's no audience there. You are just, everyone is just freely improvising.
Yeah. And there was no right or wrong too in that class. I mean, you could feel when something wasn't working, and you'd kind of take a step back. But
in a class that is so free, did Avery Schreiber have anything to say, or was it just a playground?
It was kind of just a playground, but he was playing with us, so that's what made it different. He wasn't the kind of teacher that would sit and watch. Mm-hmm. He was part of it, and that's kind of what I'll always remember about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that he would be there. So he is, quote unquote, teaching the class, but really you were all kind of teaching yourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was in there with
you. And a lot of people from Second City were coming in to work with us. Betty Thomas was there on numerous occasions. Mm-hmm. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful place to be. So
Betty Thomas, Christopher Knight, anyone else from that class?
Gosh, I'll have to.
Okay.
No.
Well, Avery Schreiber's done.
Dan Seymour. He was a Superman.
He was a villain of Superman. Yes. Actually, bullets. He shot him. He tried to shoot him.
Yes.
And then threw the gun.
Yes.
After Avery Schreiber, was it just going from class to class and various studies?
A funny thing happened. Universal did a show called the Don Adams Screen Test. And
I have seen this episode that you have shown me, and Don Adams' Screen Test was a game show, right?
Right. Well, it was sort of a game show.
Don Adams had become famous from Get Smart, and he has this show where amateur, quote unquote, actors would come on and act scenes with professional actors, sort of against each other.
Yeah, and the idea was they wanted to get outtakes. The idea of the show was they loved what Tim and Harvey Korman did on Carol Burnett so much.
Outtakes are funnier than actually the scene.
So they wanted, the whole idea of the show was to kind of create the outtakes. The scene was the least of importance. Yeah. But I didn't know that when I got cast on the show. So I was doing On the Waterfront.
How do you do that scene from On the Waterfront? You were on there, if I may say, you were on there with George Kennedy, right?
Who is I cannot tell you how nice a man that he is.
Was he wonderful?
Yeah.
George Kennedy, very famous. Yeah. Cool Hand Luke, whatever. Airport, any millions of wonderful roles.
Naked Gun.
The Naked Gun. He's really an actor of incredible.
Dirty Dozen, which is one of my favorite.
Of course,
films of all
time. The Dirty Dozen. Yes. Yeah. So you end up at a kind of a game show, acting, but they want comic outtakes.
Right.
But you're playing a scene.
So
from
here's
On the Waterfront.
We were the first show that they take.
Oh, you're the very first episode?
Yeah, so which was weird in itself, because I don't think, and I got the scene down immediately. I mean, it was
You memorized the scene?
No. But I mean, we shot it, literally, and it was done. It was like,
There
was no outtakes, and Don Adams comes up to me and says, that was great, kid, but that's not what this show is. You know, we gotta go back and goof around. So for the rest of the afternoon, we kind of did outtakes I know that sounds very
bizarre.
You did
fake outtakes of a show because they needed you to blow the lines that you didn't actually blow because you're doing a scene from On the Waterfront with George Kennedy and you actually prepared.
Right. So, yeah, that's exactly what happened. So, from that, surprisingly.
But I should add, you won.
Yeah. Well, what?
But, no, you won. Yeah. I saw you showed me the tape years ago. Okay. No, you won.
Yes, I won a part in Midway with Charlton Heston.
You won a part in a movie?
Yes.
On a game show?
Yes.
So you won? You won? Yeah.
The funny thing is, they were going to give me a speaking part, but SAG would have not, you know, SAG said no.
Oh, you were not a member of the union?
No. Of course, this was.
May I just say that you actually did a great job in that scene with George Kennedy?
Thanks. It was actually very fun.
It was. It was really, you actually did very, very well.
So SAG said, no, we're not going to let contestants have speaking parts.
Actors Union say you can't win a role in a movie on a game show.
That's what they said. So I was a glorified extra, basically. I mean, Charlton Heston spent the day with me. I had a Navy advisor to teach me how to salute, who tried to enlist me at the end of the day. So,
are you kidding
me?
No.
So, and then a funny thing.
Well, what was Charlton Heston like? You're spending the day with him?
Again, couldn't be a nicer man. I mean, here's the star of this was a big movie in its time, and he just wanted to hang out with me.
Truly. And they just go, hey, Chuck, we had the winner of Don Adams' Screen Test. Who's won a part.
He even said to me, hey, sorry, kid, we couldn't get you a speaking part.
Well, that's nice of him.
So, now, the funny thing happened after this is they had screenings of the episodes. And I got a call from Universal saying they wanted to see me. And I go, what's this? And I don't know if the name Monique James rings a bell, but Universal had a talent department in those days where they used to.
And may I note, that's the first reference that you've made that I've actually, that I've understood.
So after numerous auditions, they were going to sign me to a new talent program. And that's when Universal closed it.
They had like when you could have a contract and the new talent program and you're under contract at Universal
and
Studios.
And you could only work in Universal Films.
So
and shows.
What did they say? They said, we want you to be part
of this. Well, we wanted you to come meet us and talk to us. And I mean, this went on for months. And just when they were going to make a decision, Universal closed the department. So
you didn't get it under contract at Universal.
So
you took another class, though.
Yes, I took another class. That's when I ended up at Harvey Limbeck.
So Harvey Limbeck was, a very famous character actor in a million movies.
Yeah, you know him best from probably Stalag 17.
Stalag 17.
The Beach Party movies. Mm-hmm. Sergeant Bilko.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, he had a really pretty good career.
But he was not teaching improv per se.
No.
What was he teaching? Because
he called it comedy. And to give you an idea, we even did a night of spit takes and wingdings to give you an idea of what that class was.
So this was kind of like an old time comedy class from the old time veteran who's saying, kid, this is how you do the proper spit take.
Right. And we actually did things like that. So, I mean, spit I can take. Actually, to this day, I can actually do a spit take.
The king is dead. Long live the king. The king lives. The king lives. So that kind of a thing.
And at its height, Harvey's class was like, and I didn't realize it when I was in it, but this was the height of comedy in Los Angeles.
Well, that's what that
was. I didn't realize. I mean, a lot of people who were there just didn't realize that.
But the Avery Schreiber class, that was at the inception of improv and the Viola Spolin, the theater games and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Then you get into this class, which was kind of, as years went by, a who's who of comedy performers in Los Angeles.
Right. When I started, John Ritter was there, John LaRoquette, Robin Williams had just joined, and the list goes on and on and
right,
on.
Right, right, right. I mean, the Harvey Limbeck, I mean, Michael Limbeck, his son, is now a very prominent TV director. So Robin is in the class.
Yeah.
LaRoquette. Were these guys, what did you do? Did you prepare a scene or?
No, he wouldn't throw you into the ocean to begin with. You had to see, he had to prove you wanted to be there. So you would sit sometimes for 2 months before he even put you in something.
You had to sit.
Yeah, you just
sit
you
in your little uncomfortable chair in the
back,
little tiny theater.
And you'd just watch and watch. And maybe he'd tell you to go come another night. When I was there, he had two nights. He had a Monday night and a Tuesday night. And he said, come Tuesday. And it's just sitting there. Tuesday night was not quite the glossier celebrities.
Right.
But there was something more comfortable about Tuesday night.
So Tuesday you were a little less a little less nervous because Robin Williams and John LaRoquette and whomever, John Ritter, who was he doing Three's Company at the time?
God, the year was about, I'm trying to remember the year. The year was about, what was it, 76 or 7? So I guess...
Robin Williams didn't do Mork yet.
No, he had not done... I was with Robin the first night Mork aired. And the first time, we were the Ginger Man.
Again.
Well, that was Harvey's...
With Jack Lemmon. Harvey would go there...
We went there every night after class. In fact, Carol O'Connor, after Harvey died, actually put a little sign on Harvey's stool.
Really?
Yeah, so until the restaurant closed, that was always there. But I was with Robin the night Mork and Mindy premiered. And it was a very odd night because that was the first time I had ever seen like photographers following somebody. And they were all out in front and he was trying to hide. And
So like the night he got famous.
Yeah, the night he got famous.
Wow.
Yeah.
And was... So you just did scenes, or Harvey would get up and demonstrate something, and you had to copy.
You'd have a theme for the night, and it would vary, you know. And he would throw out suggestions, and everybody took their turn doing the scene. A lot of times there were 2-person scenes, 3-person scenes. Sometimes they'd grow. He liked people who would sing. He wanted you to sing in scenes. There's no accompaniment. We had no piano players.
He wanted you to sing. I mean, just
out of He
would sing any song.
He just wanted to free you. I remember he had this one exercise that everyone was terrified of. It was called Laughter to Tears. And you had to come up and do a monologue where you start laughing, where you slowly transition into tears. And he didn't want...
I have heard about that exercise many a time.
It was terrifying. People used to not show up to class thinking that was coming. So,
really?
Yeah, that scared the bejesus out of everyone.
And he would just call on anyone at random. Hey, yeah. Ned, get up there and do a laughter to tears.
It wouldn't just be me. If we were doing laughter to tears,
everyone had to do it tonight.
Yeah, it was everyone.
So it's Ned's turn. Get up there, start a monologue. It makes you laugh. You're laughing hysterically, and you make it realistic that it turns to tears, and you begin sobbing.
And it was terrifying. It was terrifying, to be very honest.
Did you ever see Robin Williams do that one?
No, I didn't see Robin.
John Larroquette? John Ritter?
No, not John Ritter. No.
See, I knew they couldn't do it.
Yeah. They probably can't.
They probably John Ritter could have.
Yeah, see, he's good.
Could have.
And Harvey's became the place where people would come and pick out, you know, people to sign. Robin got Gary Marshall saw Robin there, and
in
put
the
him
class,
in and put him in Happy Days.
Put him in that guest star on Happy Days as Mork for Mork,
right?
Which became Mork and Mindy,
right? So what happened was slowly what changed about the class was Paramount started putting people in the class they wanted in the class.
Oh,
so Scott Baio was in the class,
uh-huh.
And a lot of people
because he was playing Chachi on Happy Days. So Paramount says, "Hey, Harvey, take this kid under your wing, and teach him a little shtick the laughter to tears thing."
So the class started changing, and then eventually what happened was we actually moved to Paramount. Paramount gave Harvey the old commissary to run classes there, and their only rule was they could put in anyone they wanted.
Oh, so, boy, that's almost unheard of now.
Yeah, so.
That a studio said, wow, well.
This was a golden age of Paramount. I mean, we were on the lot all the time. So Mork and Mindy was taping, Cheers, Laverne and Shirley, Happy Days. They were still all on the air. And that was the hottest studio, in comedy, period. Nobody touched what they were doing. You know, some of it was very good, some of it was very bad, but it was just a fun place to hang out and be. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But what changed was Harvey's Theater in Beverly Hills was a very little small intimate thing. And you know comedy. Move comedy to a big room and all of a sudden
everything changes. Yeah, once just raise the ceiling 3 feet and it's totally different.
So all of a sudden we were in this very large ex-commissary on Paramount and the class it wasn't clicking like it did. Everything kind of had changed. And one night Harvey had a massive heart attack and it was over.
In the class?
No, not after class one night.
After class one night, he just died.
Yeah.
And so, that was it.
That was it. So the class still exists to this day. Helene, who's Harvey's daughter, is a teacher there.
Didn't Michael take it on
Michael
for a while?
Michael took it on for
Michael,
a while.
His son.
And they're very funny people. And if anyone's ever looking for a class, it's a great place to start. It really is.
And her name was Helene?
Yeah, Helene.
Helene?
Limbeck, yeah.
Limbeck, okay.
She was on Welcome Back, Kotter. She was a character.
Horshack?
No.
That's Ron Palillo. Sorry.
Ron Palillo.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
So.
I was trying to go.
No, that's okay.
Another Larry Storch thing.
So after Harvey died, I was kind of, I didn't know where to go or what to do. And I tried stand up with a friend of mine, Anson. And This is a very funny story.
So you were okay, but you improv. You've exhausted that. You took your shtick, but you hadn't done it in front of a real like paying audience with drinks and stuff.
I did it. I used to work the Renaissance Fair in summers.
You did. What did you do there?
We used to improv in front of the toilets and make fun of people going in the bathroom. So
well, that's always man's got to make a living.
Yes. So.
But you hadn't done it. You hadn't considered, hey, I've got to figure out a way to go in front of paying people and maybe make $20 out of this.
That's right. So
because it's all I'm paying now. Right. I'm paying Harvey. I'm paying Avery Schreiber. Right. I'm paying everyone in order to perform. Right. I got to find a place where at least it's free. Right. If not, I get paid a little tiny bit.
You got it.
So you go to the comedy store.
I mean, I took other acting workshops that were such a waste of money, and I'm sure you know about those.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, I signed up for one called the Film Actors Workshop, and they were actually on the Warner Brothers lot. And as a kid, you go, well, they're on the lot. I'm in this class.
Right. They must be watching for movie stars in this class, right?
So basically, it was a soap opera class, and boy, did I not fit there. So
it was just kind of turning
they
from people.
You, yeah.
Whenever you're angry at a character, you must turn from them.
Yes. Joan, what did you do?
It was like and that. Cut to commercial.
That wasn't working. So like I say, me and my friend Anson tried stand-up. The first night we tried it, it was this little club on Louise and in Ventura, in Encino. And I don't remember. You probably know.
What was that called?
I remember
the club. Yeah.
Okay. So we're getting ready to go up, and we'll talk about nervous. So the MC comes up right before us and goes, ladies and gentlemen, John Lennon has been shot and killed. And now the comedy stylings of Ned Nansen. And I swear that's exactly how it was. And everybody, you should have seen the faces in that crowd. I mean, my face too, but everyone's mouth had dropped. You know, people were weeping. And here we're going on stage for the first time, doing stand-up.
So, in front of a crowd who was openly weeping.
Yeah, openly weeping. So,
how'd that go?
Oh, well, that was our first and only night.
Yeah. Oh, as a team.
Yeah, as a team, yes.
As a team.
That kind of ended it. So.
Yeah, because Anson was a little high-strung, remember.
Yeah, he's very funny, though. In his own way.
Yes. In his own way, in a high-strung funniness, but I'm sure that would have seared into his psyche, and he couldn't do it again. Now Anson went off because that's I met you after that, but that was a time
I met Anson on a film. We did a film called The Greatest Thing That Almost Happened, which is famous because it was Jimmy Walker's first dramatic role. But for someone whose first real film, I was working with James Earl Jones. So
James Earl Jones was in the. What did he play?
Jimmy Walker's dad.
So Jimmy Walker, you can't call him Jimmy J.J. Dynamite Walker.
Don't ever
do that. So, don't do that.
It was Brian Kerwin's first film, if you know Brian.
Yeah, sure.
So I think it was one of Anson's first films. We all met.
So you met on the movie.
We all met doing the movie. And
you all met in Jimmy Walker's first movie.
Yes.
Hanging out with the future voice of Darth Vader.
That's right.
And
Debbie Allen was in the movie.
Wow. Yeah, and you guys say, hey, let's make a comedy team. You tried it one night. John Lennon died. I'm not blaming you two. I'm just saying that happened at the same time.
Yes, that's
that on that night.
So, yeah. So that brings us to around 1980. And, you know, they started doing improv at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And they were. You could go, you know, they always had the open nights for stand-up, but they never had the open nights for improv. And I thought, let's go watch, maybe give it a try. Everyone had heard stories about Mitzi. You know, she was, even then, this is 1981. This is just after the Steve Lubitkin.
The Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip. I came into town. Right at the end of a very tumultuous time when the stand-up comedians were on strike.
Right.
One of them, for whatever reason, for reasons still kind of unknown, but was despondent about not playing the Comedy Store and that sort of thing, actually jumped off the Hyatt Hotel, which was right next door to the Comedy Store, trying to land on the Comedy Store, landed next to the Comedy Store. Jay Leno, I know many people were actually standing in the parking lot when it happened. But this was – and you and I separately, but we both came – you know, walked up Sunset Boulevard and into the Comedy Store
right at the same time.
After that time.
Yeah.
Just
there were no alarm. I wouldn't cross picket lines. I didn't want to do.
No. Nor would I.
But well, tell me what brought how you what where how long had you been in LA before you went to the comic store? Tell me the story of how you led up to actually going there.
I just that was the first week I was in LA. I went to the Improv because most of my friends worked at the Improv. Guys I knew from New York City in comedy and everything. I knew Rich Hall. Rich was over at the Improv, and I went to the Improv for the open mic night to try to get on stage, try to be an Improv regular, and all that stuff. Rich was, which was very nice to me, trying to meet Bud and introduce me to Bud. And, you know, I'm standing there, and Rich finally, Bud Friedman comes by, owner of the Improv. And Rich says, Bud, this is a, you know, friend of mine, Tom Wilson here from the East Coast, just moved in. Bud Friedman looked at me and said, get out of my way.
Was there a reason for that? Or
no, I just, that was Bud at the time, I think. He just, get out of my way. I mean, I was in his way or in the way of somebody, so I just kind of, oh, okay. So I didn't get to meet him, and I didn't get a time. I never got on stage at the Improv. In fact, late that night, I mean, 2:15 in the morning, when it's clear the last names have been drawn to perform for the two sleeping people in the showroom, and there are, you know, let's say a dozen people left, and one guy is sitting the piano, and it's very clear that none of us, you know, each of us has shown up there at 6 o'clock at night. It's 2:15. None of us are going to get on stage, and he literally starts playing the piano. There's no business like show. I'm not making this up. It's like in a dream. It's out of a movie. I swear it happened. And he's just singing like, I know everything about it is a piece. And Ned, as God is my witness, one at a time, people start singing. People start. The guy next to him starts, everything the traffic will allow. And everyone's to know, where can you get that happy feeling? I swear to you, 2:15 at the Improv, a dozen misfit losers like myself singing at the top of their lungs, let's go on with the show. So it was like that. But I went out on Melrose Boulevard thinking there's only one other place really that's a major place. And then, as you know, you went off to the little delis and the little dance clubs that would have comedy on a Tuesday night. But it was the Improv and the Comedy Store. So I just Rich was very nice that night. I said, sorry about that. Hey, go over to the Comedy Store. The fact is, with LA, one of the owners just takes a shine to you.
Right.
They like what you're doing.
Also, if you get picked at one club, they don't want you there.
Exactly. So
you were blacklisted.
He just said, look, that's the way you do it. So go up there and give it a try. And it was the next night, because the Improv was Sunday night, was open mic night. The Comedy Store was Monday night. Right. I went up that Monday night, and absolutely unheard of in comedy. And I'm not saying it was me or my performance. It just so happened the stars aligned. Mitzi was sitting in the booth. She wasn't on the phone. I went up at enough guys didn't show up for their spots that I went on early enough for her to see me.
Do you remember who was playing that night or who was on the show?
Well, Robert Aguayo was the MC. I remember seeing Greg Travis, who was a comedian at that time, who was very hot. And it was just like the kid who had a really good fastball in AAA ball, but he's coming into the pros. He's walking up to Fenway Park, you know. So Greg Travis was on stage in the original room, and he was destroying. He was blowing the roof off the place. And the fact is, the material, the performance was really good. And it was really eye-opening. It was really, in that way, it was invigorating to me, but in the same way, scary, because you're saying, boy.
Did you change what you did after seeing that?
I did not change what I did.
Okay.
I didn't change what I did. But it was like, wow, this is the big leagues. Boy, they're really, you know, they're really great.
So had you been doing your act in Philadelphia?
Oh, yeah. I'd been doing it in New York and Philadelphia. So I was a pretty polished, for a young guy.
Right.
I was
How
a young
you?
Kid. When I got there, I was 21.
Wow.
So I had done a lot of shows, but not in L.A., not on the Sunset Strip. So to make a long story, you know, I got on stage, and Bob Aguayo comes up with his jaw on the ground saying, well, this is never, you know, but Mitzi saw you and you're a regular. So
wow, that's pretty
calling for
pretty,
spots
for anyone who doesn't know that's pretty darn amazing.
That is just it's just unheard of.
Yeah.
And like I said, it was, you know, it was lucky, but she just the next week I started getting spots at the Comedy Store.
Now, how did you end up in the improv room? Did she put you there, or did she want you to?
At the improv? Well, no. At that time, as you said, the main room on Monday nights was improv and improv groups.
Right.
So I wanted to do it because I was doing stand-up. I had done improv. I was improvising a lot on stage anyway. So I wanted to do the improv stuff because, as you know, as we talked about, I mean, that was the thing. It was really happening. It was really creative. Right. It was really something. So I wanted to be in an improv group. They had a thing, as you know, called the Potluck Players.
Right.
That was sort of like an open mic improv. Andy Garcia did it.
Yes, I remember.
Andy Garcia was in the Potluck Players for a number of years there, and you showed up early and the Potluck Players played first, and it was like, you know, 40 people would get on the stage.
I remember being in a scene with in a fake car with Fred Asparagus and Andy Garcia, and I don't know why I have this image of this pretend car. And,
right.
And I think that was my first night there.
Yeah, so Andy Garcia or whomever,
right.
You were in the car, and they would either pick a playwright or some theater game. You know, you guys are going to what? And everyone, you know, whatever. Gynecologist office, four guys, ha, 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 whatever. And then someone would come up with a funny line, and then you would tap that guy on the shoulder. If you had a funny line, you would tap Andy Garcia on the shoulder. Andy Garcia would go into the crowd of 40 people back in there. You would sit down in the car, and when it was your turn, you would have your little funny line, and then someone would tap you on the shoulder. An almost impossible way to get noticed by everyone, because you really had to work hard.
And to my surprise, my first night I was there, Mitzi called me over.
See, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
So Mitzi would be in a booth, and everyone's just trying to come up with funny lines.
And it's very scary when she calls you over, because I didn't know her.
Right.
That was my first night there.
So you get called up, and then she puts you
in a group.
In a group.
She said,
in a group.
You're going to be in a group. The name is Butterscotch.
So you were in the group. I was in the group Strudel.
Yes.
Okay.
Who was in the original Strudel?
The original Strudel was Howie Gold, Judy Toll, Robert Townsend, and myself. And then Arsenio Hall.
Arsenio was in our group at one point.
Arsenio was in you. Arsenio was moving groups. Arsenio moved groups quite a bit.
Arsenio was in and out of our group in one night.
So. Arsenio was in our group for a while, and there were people who would come in and out there, but that was the core of the group was Robert Townsend and Howie Gold and Judy and myself, and Melissa Harrison did stuff with us as well, and some of the Comedy Store Players, but you. Were in Butterscotch.
Right, and I was in a group with a tall guy named Robert Barber.
Who is now Riley Barber.
Riley Barber.
He's out there, Riley Barber, but he was Robert back then.
And Greg Berg, who used to do voices on Muppet Babies.
We always thought he was so cool because he did animation voices.
I know,
and we were all
we're
so
all jealous,
young. We're like, how do you do that? How do you get that gig?
And a really young kid we just clicked, and it was his Bill Hicks.
Now, I know I was trying to get to this because the fact is you and I were very early friends of Bill Hicks.
Right.
When he was new to Los Angeles.
Right. He would ride his bike to the Comedy Store.
Exactly. So I'll try to fill in, but you tell me about meeting Bill, because Bill was a member of your improv group, Butterscotch.
Right. Bill was kind of a geeky. He must have been 17 or 18 at the time. I'm just guessing. I don't know. He actually wore these Charlie Brown-like shirts.
With the horizontal stripes like you'd wear in ninth grade.
Right. He actually looked kind of like Charlie Brown. And we loved the same kind of things. We liked Chaplin, Harold Lloyd. We used to go to the silent movies together. And we started writing together. And we wrote these really weird, bizarre skits. We wrote one about the People's Court, and it turns into the
That was a very funny bit. You and Bill wrote a sketch where it's the People's Court and Judge Wapner,
right.
And it's just about the fence on a person's property,
right.
And they end up actually convicting him of the Kennedy assassination.
Right. Yes, it was Bill. Bill had even at that age there was a little dark side to him, but that's what I loved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember we wrote on the spot a Christmas. Skit, and it was about how everybody got yachts and cars and everything for Christmas, and Bill got a sock, and we were all on the yacht, and everyone fell overboard, and Bill saved us with his sock. So it was our gift of the Magi at the Comedy Store.
Yeah, so. Bill ended up to have the best gift of all.
Yeah.
The sock that saved everyone's life. But for those people who are huge Bill fans, and not denigrating him at all, because Bill was a brilliant writer and performer, but it's almost impossible to convince them that Bill wore those Charlie Brown-like T-shirts and wore Chuck Taylor Converse and like
curse.
Blue jeans and just hung out with us. Us, you know, guys who didn't do that stuff, who were just, you know, I think we, you, me, whoever, Andy Garcia, but we're dedicated.
Sam Kissin.
Well, not Sam so much. Well, Sam was, we'll get to that in a moment. But no, I'm talking about you, me, Bill, and a number of guys who were really into the show itself.
Right.
The preparation, the performance, that was what it was about. It was it was kind of cool to be in showbiz or whatever, and people were saying, wow, that's so hip to be the Comedy Store. But really, it was like building something and putting it out in front of people.
But something I want to remind you is the main the original room was packed every night. There was a line going out the door. But the main room for the improv...
Oh, it was a ghost town.
Yeah, we'd have... 20 people on a good night.
And we're talking about a room that fits 400 people.
Yeah,
so. And maybe you would have 20 people in the audience.
So a lot of times we were doing it for us.
Right. You were doing it for the other comics.
Yeah.
You were doing it for the groups that were before and after you.
I mean, things changed later when Robin started showing up a lot.
Well, Robin, yes. Robin, changed things. But no, you're right. We were doing all of our things. And then Mork and Mindy happens.
Right.
Robin gets more gigantic than you can...
Yeah, I don't think anyone can realize how famous he
was.
I mean, truly, truly famous. I mean, he was the first, even more so than Steve Martin. Do you know what I mean? I mean, he had fans that would...
Oh, yeah. So the place was selling a lot more tickets.
Yes.
And no matter what sketch you were doing or improv you were doing, no matter what this scene was... Robin Williams could just step on stage at any moment.
That he wanted to.
And just become Dr. Number Two.
Yes.
Or anything.
Yes.
You know, taxi cab could actually end up with two drivers.
It happened quite often.
It happened, you know, he'd just step on stage, pull up a chair, and just sit down.
Were you there the night of the rat?
I was there the night of the rat.
Tell the story of the night of the rat.
Robin was on stage. Doing one of his fanciful monologues, and the crowd starts murmuring and everything, and a giant rat runs
size
out.
Of a cat,
oh man, the thing was huge, and there was kind of, what would you say,
it almost looked like a prop, because the way it stopped in the middle,
there was like a handrail that went across the front of the stage that opened. And it would be, sometimes it had lights in it, and the lights would light up and make it all show busy. But this rat climbed to the top of this handrail, and right in front of an entire audience was like balancing, doing a tightrope walk along this handrail across as the audience starts noticing and just absolutely freaking out.
And Robin, I think, did an hour on the rat.
We might as well have just packed our things and gone, because he sees the rat. The rat stops. The rat scampers off, and Robin goes into, I don't know. I know it was longer than the entire Inagata DeVita album.
That's 17 minutes.
Oh, just that. No, that's the song, not the entire album.
The whole album.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Are You Happy? I mean, all the songs.
The Comedy Store at that time was a very strange. It was becoming strange. It was changing. And you could kind of feel a cloak of darkness. I mean, when I first came to the Comedy Store, maybe it was dark all the time, but I didn't see that or notice that, you know. And around this time, there were comics bringing guns to the store.
Yes, I know. I guess maybe you shouldn't say that, you know, somebody chased somebody around with a gun, but somebody did chase another comic around the Comedy Store with a gun and like tackled him with a gun and stuff. There was sort of gunplay.
It was becoming a very kind of dark and creepy place. There's a story that I want you to tell. I'm sure you've told it many, many times. Is that when you and Sam Kinison?
Well, that's become comedy folklore because it's been on several podcasts.
Put it on the podcast. Have you told it on the podcast?
I don't think I've told it on this podcast, but on other podcasts.
I want you to tell a story because this is a...
Look, we met Sam Kinison, right? Who you talk about it, the kind of things he was doing.
Sam was different. I'll compare Sam and Andy Clay, because what I liked about Andy Clay was an act. That wasn't, you know, Andy wasn't the brightest bulb on the planet, but Andy wasn't really, to me, the guy he was playing.
Right.
Sam was.
Right. I'm going to stop it there because we're at about an hour, and I just went on and on with Ned, so I'm going to do a second part with Ned. I hope you're enjoying it. It was a fascinating time, certainly in our lives, and really in the history of American entertainment, oddly. But it is true, Bill Hicks wore little Charlie Brown t-shirts, Chuck Taylors, and blue jeans. And we were both very good friends with Bill, and well, I'll talk about Bill another time. But thanks so much for stopping by. Tell a friend, would you? Consider subscribing to the podcast. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing, to Chris and Katie over Nerdist, to McPherson Guitars and Dean Markley Strings for helping me out in my live show. Come out to a live show if you care to, and I will talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.